Welcome to episode 7 of Time for Tea 1903, Macintosh at the Willow podcast. Isabel, do you want to give yourself some tea?
Yes, I was actually waiting for you to pour it, but you're incredibly rude, so...
It's just, I felt like, because I set up the microphone and the laptop and got the cups and went downstairs and got the milk.
Nah.
And then
you're giving yourself
heated up the teapot and then got the tea. So maybe you could pour your own tea?
Nah.
It's just the division of labour, but fine. Okay. It's fine.
Wait.
I thought I would open by asking you a little question, Isabel, right? I'm just going to spring it on you.
Okay.
Please, can you identify the song from the following lyrics? Are you ready?
Okay.
Don't go for second best, baby. Put your love to the test. Think 80s, a diva, blonde hair. That's it.
What is it? Blonde. Oh, it's Madonna.
Oh,
it's my God. My question to you now, Jodie, is why are you asking me this?
I'm asking you this because Madonna's song, Express Yourself, as well as Blade Runner, The Addams Family, the TV science fiction show Babylon 5, mm-hmm. the other TV science fiction show Star Trek, the film American Psycho, Inception, which is probably one of my favourite films ever, and Doctor Who.
I like Inception. You're a freak.
Get off the podcast.
No.
All of these films and TV shows all feature Macintosh chairs. And I know you're going to be like, what, Madonna? But yeah, Madonna, Express Yourself, right? So picture the scene, because I've watched this video a few times.
Dude, how did you get to this? How did you find this out?
Because I did my research.
You're crazy.
Did my research. So imagine, right, this is the video, right? It's in like a factory. There's lots of like industrial equipment. Cogs, actually. So there's no real equipment. There's just cogs. And then men without their shirts on.
Like, for some reason, Saturday for me.
Yeah, like moving the cogs themselves, which is not how a cog works usually. Anyway, so they're in this warehouse doing this, and then Madonna turns up in her skimpy underwear because it was the era of her just wearing her underwear,
More power to her.
Singing the song "Express Yourself," and then she crawls through a dining room, which isn't obviously in the factory, so that's weird, which is full of Macintosh Argyle chairs. Usually, you know, we know them from Miss Cranston's tea room in Glasgow, turn of the century tea room, but here they are in Madonna's video, Express Yourself. And then she crawls and crawls and crawls, and then she laps up a bowl of milk that's been left for a cat. Very versatile
interior
chairs.
Design feature.
Really? So it's nice to be talking about chairs because Macintosh, famous for chairs, right? I think that's how I probably first encountered Macintosh. I knew he made chairs. And then after that, I learned everything else about him. But he was a chairman, right? Chairman of the chairs.
Chairman Mac.
He wasn't chairman of anything, I don't think. But anyway. So we're talking about chairs in the building. Isabella, there's loads of different chairs here. Have you got a favourite?
Well, probably the cashier's chair.
Good choice. Why?
Because that's roomy for the butt cheeks.
Yes.
And skirts, if you were, as Miss Cranston was, wearing large Victorian skirts.
Yeah.
It's got a nice high back so you can rest a bit. Yeah. And you can also stash all of your countless amounts of money in the box underneath it.
Yeah, right? That's a good choice. And we'll talk about the cashier's chair today. So we're going to talk about chairs in the building and also a feature, a very interesting architectural feature, like a sculpture, I think of it really, in the tea rooms that sits above some of the chairs. I see that you've got a history of chairs. Have you printed off history of chairs there?
So what I've done is I've compiled research from different sources. And we have ended up with, quite a lot of the history of chairs.
I'm going to limit you to 30 seconds, because I believe the history of chairs is longer than 30 seconds. Much, much longer, but we're mainly here to talk about these chairs. So you can tell me anything from the past, if you like, in your history of chairs.
The first example of chairs, from what I can tell, is your thrones, or chairs that were found in ancient Egypt.
So Adam and Eve, chairless. Naked and chairless. I guess what I wanted to bring up about the history of chairs before we talk about Macintosh chairs specifically is that obviously Macintosh was inspired by Japan. This building's very Japanese, right? But the Japanese culture was very slow to take up chairs.
Mm-hmm.
And actually,
they weren't into it.
They just weren't really into chairs. I was reading a history that said that Japan was essentially tatami mat-based culture. Well into like the 1860s.
Are they the sort of woven ones.
Just to stuff on the floor.
They're quite fine.
Yeah, because tatami mats are like a big part of Japanese interior design. You actually measure a room, right, in how many mats it holds. Still do that today.
Really?
Yeah, rather than square footage, you say like how many mats it holds.
That's cool.
So a lot of Japanese like activities involve sitting down. They still involve sitting down. So it's interesting that Macintosh, as much as he loved loads of Japanese things, he still went for Western chairs in here, because imagine Mr. Cranston wouldn't have had the lady sitting down on
no
mats.
Way. Right? Yeah, exactly.
So it's not a property room, because people are sitting on chairs.
And the chairs are a huge, huge part of the design features.
Right, exactly. So, and actually I've got a quote about that. So wrap your ears around this, tell me what you think about this. Macintosh was fascinated by the nature of transition. The back of a Macintosh chair is not just a support, and perhaps in some of his designs not even a support, rather it is a spatial marker which indicates a boundary between a place for sitting and a place for walking. Furthermore, it is a statement of the nature of presence and void. For good or ill, Macintosh chairs insist on their spatial presence more than other chairs. When they are unoccupied, they are preeminent in a room. When someone sits on one of them, they almost become diminished. They just pull focus, don't they? We say in theatre, something pulls focus. All eyes are on the chair.
Yeah. Also interesting that they're talking about how the chairs are part of socialising, as in, if you look across the tea rooms, a lot of the high back chairs do create a small, more private space, but all of them are perforated in some way, so you can see everyone, but then you still have this feeling of having your own space.
Mm. Yeah, they kind of work like little walls, don't they? Like, you could categorise them as architectural features, in a way, because they just are extensions of the
100%.
Of the walls and the corridors and stuff like that, really. The more I learned about Macintosh chairs, the more I was impressed about him thinking about what a chair is for, right? Because I was just like, it's for sitting on. But as we said, it's like he treats it as a structure that changes the space around it and changes the way people navigate the spaces and things like that, really. So we've got loads of chairs in the building. We've got 400 pieces of handmade furniture,
mm-hmm.
which is a lot, right? That's part of the reason why it took us so long to restore. We had 3 furniture makers who came and made them all by hand. I always say on the tour, like when I tell people that everything's handmade, the chairs are handmade, I say that we just want people to feel like you're sat on something that's made with a bit of care, a mm-hmm. bit of love, really. And I think they do feel quite special.
Probably reflects the original idea that it's a Gewandhauskunstwerk, so everything's been made by craftsmen.
So I guess we're going to give a shout out to the furniture makers who made these amazing chairs straight away. So Bruce Hamilton, so they're all made locally, which is lovely. Bruce Hamilton made the little chairs that we've got, 33 armchairs. Angus Ross made 125 ladder back chairs. And Kelvin Murray made our amazing Salon Deluxe chairs and the cashier's chair. So we're going to hear about the Salon Deluxe chairs a wee bit later. But what a great commission, right? I think all of those furniture makers said they were delighted to be asked to make a Macintosh chair and that it was really hard.
Yeah, it was the idea of actually using Charles Ray Macintosh's design to create an object.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
So I looked at these chairs, so I'm going to tell you stuff that you might know, Isabella, but you might not know already. So the ladder backs and the box armchairs, first of all, they're all black, right? All the furniture's black, and it's... Again, that's very Japanese, right? You forget that the Victorian chairs are all brown. Everyone had brown chairs everywhere. And to come in here and see all this ebonized black everywhere must have been a real shock, right? The black is a black stain mixed with black oil and then topped with black wax. So when I say they're black, I mean they are black.
Yes.
They are really black chairs. And that's why we're drinking Congou black tea today, which is less black.
It's really, really tasty.
Yeah, it's nice, isn't it? Right. So there's 125 ladder backs. And during the podcast research, I learned, because I wanted to figure out how the ladder backs were made, that they contain a mortise and tenon joint. So I'm gonna waggle some paper at Isabella so she can see. That's how everything's joined on the chairs.
Cool.
Everything's slotting in. That little bit goes into that bit there. And all of these mortise joints had to be made by hand. So that means there are 3,250 mortise and tenon joints. Every single one of them were cut by hand. That's why it took so long to make these ladder back chairs. So long.
That's it. Every one of them is a piece of artwork.
exactly right. And that's just the wood, obviously it's oak. And then the rush seat pad on them, that also took a whole day to make. So they are just, like you said, they're works of art in themselves, aren't they? Which is amazing when you consider it's, there's even greater pieces of art all around you, but you're still sat on this amazing thing. Are you a ladderback girl or are you a box armchair girl?
I quite like the box armchair, but I have to say sometimes I slouch, so maybe posture-wise, a ladderback.
The cashier's chair, though, that you picked as your favourite is also, I have to say, quite an extrovert chair because it dominates the space. It's right in the middle of the tea rooms as well. You'd be like...
I just thought it was quite a versatile object, you know? You could use it, you could put it in your hallway and put a telephone on it. Not that we use telephones anymore.
I've got some information about the cashier's chair.
Tell me.
As you know, and I'll describe it for listeners who haven't seen it, it's a large crescent-shaped latticework back atop a coupered base. Essentially, it's like a great big half-moon chair, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's massive. Calvin Murray, who made it, it took him 6 weeks to make that one chair.
That was amazing.
Can you figure out why it took him so long to make that chair?
It's the latticework. Yeah. Like, so that's all individual pieces put together.
Wow, yeah, amazing. So it's a lattice work. Every single lattice infill had to be shaped and fitted individually. So as Isabel said, there's a shape of like the willow tree at the back of this beautiful curved chair, but it's made up of like hundreds of little voids, right? And he had to like use a hand tool to sand and curve every single void in the chair.
None of the chairs in the building have a completely solid back to them.
No.
But like a car, it's all like, I think it obviously lets light through as well.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It's interesting. But again, it's the people watching Jodie. So you can look around and be like, who's over there?
Yeah, and also I think that because they, like the ladderbacks, they've got all these void spaces in, they actually appear quite light, even though they're made of, they're black, you know?
Yeah.
That kind of works.
So they're not too bad. They're quite, like, they're dark, so they're not too dense.
Yeah, they're not too dense, exactly, right? Yeah, so that's these are the chairs that we have downstairs, these black chairs, which I really like, and I think they work really well with the bright colours of the room, like the pinks and the purples and stuff. Tell us about the baldacchino, which is also kind of works with this furniture downstairs, draws attention to itself.
Just as a side point here, Jodie and I pronounce it differently, and apparently, according to an Italian lady, it's allowed. So the baldacchino is a massive, incredibly dominant structure that sits in the centre of the front saloon in the main tea rooms. So it's the first thing you see when you come in. It's huge, isn't it? It spans right up to the ceiling. It's connected visually to this lighting ring that kind of circles the whole of the front, well, a very large portion of the front of the tea rooms there in the front saloon. And the idea of it, I think, is obviously to represent a tree with its overarching canopy being that lighting rig. Baldacchino, the term, comes from baldachin or baldaquin, is a canopy that's usually placed over an altar or a throne. And the shape of the structure itself is actually cruciform. So two interesting things to notice in sort of a potentially ecclesiastical sense. In the centre of the, sort of elevated in the centre, is this big dish as well that holds little glass tubes, and they are used for flowers. So in, some people call it a big sort of flower vase, essentially, and suggested that Miss Cranston would actually bring her own flowers from her garden to have them adorn the baldacchino. But I know that a lot of the metalwork was by Anne Dawson, who is a master blacksmith. Fellow of the worshipful company of blacksmiths. He worked on that with his 15-year-old apprentice, so that's something that's super impressive.
How do you get to be a member of a worshipful anything?
I don't know, but I'm going to ask him.
Is it a worshipful company, is that what you said?
Alan Dawson, master blacksmith and fellow of the worshipful... Why can't I say worshipful? Worshipful company of blacksmiths.
I want to be in a... I think it's like, you know, with mongers, there's like a cheesemonger, a warmonger, an ironmonger.
Yeah.
I wonder what other worshipful companies of there are. Because it can't just be blacksmiths.
Breadmonger.
That's just... You just made that up.
Yeah.
I don't think you can be in the worshipful company of and be a monger. I feel like they're mutually exclusive.
Beer monger.
Again, I've already told you there's a limited number of mongers. Yeah. Cheese, iron and war.
Grass monger.
Again.
That's when you cut the grass.
There are no more mongers.
You don't know that.
I do because I've looked it up.
Why did you look it up?
Because when my friend had a job in the cheesemonger,
right.
I said, that's amazing that you're a monger. And then I went to find out how many other monger professions there were.
So, but a warmonger, that's a completely different vibe to a cheesemonger.
Nah, they make stuff. If anyone who listens is in a worshipful company of something other than blacksmiths, get in touch.
Explain this more to us. Speaking of worship, the baldacchino is actually...
Oh, seamless.
Whoa! a baldacchino, I was saying about it being a canopy that's usually found over an altar or throne. I believe you can actually find one in the Vatican. Mm. So yeah, but basically by employing an interior element that's usually associated with a focus of worship, McIntosh is kind of making a tongue-in-cheek joke to the loyal following that Miss Cranston would have had at this time, because she had three
groupies. You mean groupies, don't you?
The baldacchino here is actually a structure of wood and metal, and as I say, it stretches up like a tree through the centre of the room. It holds four seats at the base, and then it has the ovular light fitting, which encircles a central column.
I've never heard anyone use the word ovular before. It's great.
But yeah, in terms of worship and chairs and thrones and stuff like that, it's also just interesting to note that wooded areas were historically a really placed of great importance, basically, for religious practices. So traditionally across those religions, you have the example of the sacred, it's like broadly dubbed the sacred grove.
Because it's right in the middle, isn't it? It is a very showy, offy place to sit. So if you do like people looking at you, you sit there, don't you? And then you're the first thing people see when they come in.
There's these really beautifully constructed umbrella stands that are part of the baldacchino, and it just reminds you that McIntosh is a savvy Glaswegian and he knows how to make something beautiful but also very practical. So yeah, it's supposed to be used. Although it looks like there's a lot of pomp and ceremony, it doesn't have to be that way.
Yeah, I think it's amazing, and it features on our tactile tour as well for blind and deafblind visitors, because it's good to group, to be honest. Right, because you've got those lovely wooden, cruciform slats, as you're talking about.
I never touched it.
The chairs themselves are amazing downstairs. But then when you go up the stairs, right, when you go up the stairs into the private rooms, into the Salon Deluxe, we meet even more wonderful chairs. The Salon Deluxe chairs, only ever made for the Salon Deluxe, because they were so expensive to make for McIntosh, and expensive for us to make as well, that they never kind of... That design never left the building and went elsewhere. So I've got some information about the Salon Deluxe chairs. Now, both of us have sat on the Salon Deluxe chairs, haven't we? There's the tall throne-like ones and then the slightly shorter but still very tall chairs that sit in the window. Tell us about what's it like to sit on a Salon Deluxe chair.
It feels very proper.
Yeah.
Because it does sort of... They're not made for hours and hours of sitting and languishing, are they?
They're not made for the likes of you and me.
They weren't made for us.
Just Isabella's got her feet up on a chair at the moment, and I'm swinging on a chair, so we're probably not the original clientele for
this. I would like to clarify that my shoes aren't on the chair, though, just in case my boss is listening to this.
So they are. They do make you feel quite proper, don't they?
Yes.
Because they're like thrones, as you say, they're like... Even to the point where, I'm tall, as you know. I think this has come up in the podcast a few times. I'm a tall, tallish person, 5'10". But you, even if I'm sat on a Salon Deluxe chair, you can still see the 9 kind of ceramic pieces of glass behind my head, right? In the head plate area. Because it's so tall, right? It's so tall.
Yeah.
So I've got some information about Salon Deluxe chairs. So they were very difficult chairs to replicate because... We didn't really know what colour they were, and when Kelvin delivered the first chair to the McIntosh advisory panel, they failed it because it wasn't quite the right kind of silver finish on it. So we had to go and do some more research on it. But they got us an example of the silver finish from a coat stand, and because they knew the coat stands were the same colour as the chairs, so they could scrape off a bit of the coat stand paint and then match it, really. So yeah, Kelvin Murray, who made these... he said here that it's white primer, and then there's 5 layers of primer, or is it 5 or 6? There's a lot of layers of primer on these chairs, and then there's gold flake underneath the silver, which apparently in the certain light kind of you can see. I'm not sure if you can see it, but McIntosh thought you could see it.
Okay.
Yeah, because he put it there. Yeah, so I've got the silver top coat was reproduced by brushing on a mixture of 12 micron sized aluminium flake with resin. In a technique similar to gilding, and then you buff and polish it. So these are chairs that require quite a lot of buffing and polishing. And they're massive, so that's just a big job, isn't it, as well?
Yeah, it's a good job, there wasn't too many of them.
I'm glad it's not my job. I'm not the worshipful company of buffers. Is not a company I'm involved in. So they are amazing chairs, but Galvin Murray said that he had to make some slight modernisations of them because Macintosh essentially made a chair. Although it was functional, it was mainly decorative. Well, its purpose was to be a statement, really. And so things like central heating kind of mess with the original designs. So he's had to kind of slightly adjust how to make the chairs, ever so slightly, but essentially they're exactly the same. You know how obviously chairs are made of wood, and so there's a grain in the wood. You want the grain to run like perpendicular down your chair. You don't want it to kind of go off on an angle because that encourages a split in the wood. So in order to make sure the grain is going the right way, you have to kind of select your wood really carefully. And Macintosh, because he knew it was going to be covered in paint, that no one would notice the grain. Kelvin was very particular about getting the grain right.
Okay.
So they're dead fancy, aren't they? They're dead fancy. Isabella, if you wanted to buy a ladderback chair, a nice plain ladderback chair, how much do you think it would cost you?
£1,200.
It would cost you £40,000.
Oh, I thought you meant in the shop here.
Oh, you mean like a modern one? Yeah, a Macintosh one. If you wanted to buy an original ladderback chair, in 2015 it would cost you £40,000. And furniture and Macintosh being what it is in auctions, you can probably double that price now. For a ladderback, as we've said, ladderback, although it's a lovely chair, it's a very plain Macintosh chair, isn't it?
But it's what the chair represents, because it's a completely different way of looking at space and how to navigate space visually.
Yeah, there's a real market for them. The Argyle chair, which is the one with the bird cut out, you know, like the oval disc, ovular disc shape in the top.
God.
With the bird cut out, which is a lovely chair. That's the one that features in all of the science fiction shows.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Okay. So I want you to imagine it. Like imagine the Addams Family.
It was the ladderback.
Yeah, you'd think so, but no. Look, I've actually even figured out which chair was which. So Blade Runner, Argyle chair. Madonna, Argyle chair, lapping at a glass of milk, a bowl of milk underneath an Argyle chair. Addams Family, Argyle chair. Babylon 5 TV show and Star Trek and American Psycho. They all used the Hill House chair, which is that really long, narrow black chair, which is a ladder back, and then at the top it's got a grid of black as well.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But the Argyle chair, very popular. Why do you think they feature these chairs in like science fiction and stuff?
I mean, I guess it's completely polar opposite to the surroundings.
Because they're historic, right? They're old fashioned. Yeah. So why are designers using them in all these sci-fi shows?
That's interesting.
I guess they must look really...
They're out of place, I guess, with...
Otherworldly, maybe. Even now, they do look a little bit otherworldly, don't they? The Argyle chairs, for example.
Yeah, the long, sort of stretched out vibe. Yeah.
I just really, really enjoy them. And I'm not ashamed to say that I do enjoy the chairs very much in this building. But, you know, there are other chairs in the world, Isabella. There are other chairs in the world.
What do you mean, Jodie?
I just mean that, you know, sometimes a Macintosh chair, as beautiful as it is, isn't the right kind of chair.
There's plenty more chairs in the sea.
There's plenty more chairs in the sea, Isabel.
Cool.
So I thought, you know, that we would have a bit of fun talking about weird and wonderful chairs as well. So have you got something weird and wonderful that you want to tell me about to pitch to me as an alternative, maybe?
Kind of. I mean, first of all, my first thought... It was a hammock.
Oh.
And then I was like, is it a bed? Or is it a chair? Well,
but also
that's where I went from. And then I ended up going down a hole of Roman chairs, which is weird for me, right? And saw one called a curule. And then that's one that's like a little, it's like a little bucket like that, and it's got crossed legs.
Oh, yeah.
They revived them in the Renaissance, so you see a lot of them.
Are they quite low to the ground?
Let me just do a drawing. Hold on.
Draw me a picture.
They're like this. You know, it's like that, and there's no back to it. It's just like a cupped bit, and then these
are
the two.
Oh, yes, it's like you're sitting in a cup resting on an inverted cup. No,
yeah.
Well, sort of.
Yeah, kind of, yeah. Without any
sights. I mean, that sounds like a great tea room chair to me.
Exactly.
Made of cups.
Yeah.
Don't know why Macintosh didn't go for that. I will say, if I were to criticise Macintosh chairs, which I'm just about to do now... They're not massively comfortable.
No.
Even the ones that you design for, like, private spaces.
That's it.
They're not massively comfortable. I guess because they're works of art. But
Your question was what makes a good tea room chair.
So what do you think makes a good tea room chair?
Comfy.
How comfy though?
Not too comfy because you will pass out. You will fall. I could fall asleep standing up, but you know, if something gets too comfortable, then you're. Yeah. And also, if you're doing something like having afternoon tea, then you probably need a bit more support so that you're not flailing about with teacups in your hands, scones flapping everywhere.
Yeah, because have you ever had that experience where you go to a pub for like pub lunch?
Yeah, you just slip into the chair.
Yeah, and you're on this like really comfy couch, but you can't reach the table because you're too low and it's too far away and stuff.
Yeah.
Just going back to my history of chairs, you just make me think about. So I've been listening to this great podcast, as you know, because I bore you about it in the office. The Fall of Civilizations.
Oh, I love the sound of this podcast. I need to start listening.
Fall of Civilizations. Shout out to Paul Cooper, Fall of Civilizations, an amazing podcast.
Name man, Paul.
And I was listening to the Aztec, Fall of the Aztecs. But the Aztecs, who were not a seat-embracing nation until the Spanish invaded and conquered and massacred them all. But then they took up using seats after they were colonized, brutally colonized by the Spanish. So it's an interesting way to see the spread of colonization, is actually to see how many cultures then have to adopt chairs because their conquerors are chair people.
Western.
Right? Right, the chair that I wanted to nominate for our weird and wonderful chairs. It's not really weird and wonderful, but as you know, Isabella, as you know, a couple of years ago I went up to Sutherland and Caithness for a holiday to visit the bog up there, the peat, the flow, which is the largest peat area in Europe. Sutherland and Caithness, which is an amazing piece of part of Scotland, but they also have a particular chair called the Sutherland and Caithness chair. So I'm going to describe it for you so you can understand how amazing this chair is, because it's made in a way that is different to how everybody else makes chairs.
Okay.
So there's two kind of schools of thought for how to make a chair. You make a stool, and then you slap a back on it.
Slap a back.
Voila, chair.
Whoa.
Right? Or you make that back panel, which is the back and the legs. You know what I mean? Back and the legs.
Yeah.
And then you slap the front bit on with the other legs on.
Cool.
And the seat pad. Right? That's how 99% of all chairs are made, pretty much. It's either a stool or a version of a stool with a back on it. Or it's the back with the seat pad. But in Caithness, they make a chair in a completely different way. So in Caithness, they make the chair by making the L shape. So they make the back and the seat pad as one piece, like an L of wood, right? And then they put the legs on. Which makes them extremely valuable when you find them in auction and in museums and stuff. And one of the explanations, apparently, because I was listening to, because I'm such a nerd, I was listening to Wick Voices, which is a brilliant sound archive from the Wick Museum. Wick is in Sutherland and Caithness. The person who was talking about the chair making up there, she said that she thinks the reason that these chairs are made like this is because these Highland communities, they didn't have a person who lived there who was the furniture maker. The furniture would have been made by whoever lived there who had a craft that you could make chairs from. So like lots of coopers, people who made barrels, they might make chairs for you. Or there's people who made the ships, the shipwrights, they might have made the chairs. So they were using techniques that you would use to build a boat, to build a chair, for example.
Oh.
So I just thought that was really fascinating.
That's cool.
And when I was in Wick, I went to look at these chairs again because I'm a massive nerd. And the museum was dead proud of their chairs. And what you'll like about these chairs, Isabella, two things. They're quite low because they feature in houses that had peat fires. And you don't want the peat smoke to get in your face.
In your face, yeah.
So actually they designed them low enough so that the peat smoke would rise and go over you. Isn't that clever?
Yeah, that's interesting.
And secondly, and this is what I think you'll like about them, Caithness chairs, Sutherland Caithness chairs, always have a little bar on the front that's quite low. That's for hanging your socks on. To dry over the fire at night time. So, like when the family goes to bed, you take off your damp socks and because you've been in the bog, right? And you hang them over the little bar and then you go to bed and they're nice and toasty and dry.
What shoes are they wearing for the bog then, Jodie? The socks are getting wet.
I just think that's it's amazing to think that a place has its own kind of chair. It reminds me of Macintosh with his umbrella stand on the balcony,
exactly.
Right? I don't think we'll ever give up chairs. Do you think we'll ever give up chairs?
I don't know what else we'd be sitting on. I saw an ergonomic one, which was a like an exercise ball. And if an exercise ball and an office chair made weird chair love,
chair love,
then
Now, again, I'll have to show you the Madonna Express Yourself video, because what she does to that Macintosh chair is quite raunchy.
Oh, God. Madonna.
I'm not sure that... Well, I certainly don't think Miss Cranston would have approved. So we've pretty much run out of time with our chair chat. Feels like we've ticked off a big topic there because of Macintosh and chairs, right? And it's a shame there's not very many of them left. That's a sad thing, isn't it, really? And that people used to throw them away.
Yeah.
It used to be in skips. You hear these stories about Macintosh chairs just tossed in skips. Yeah, so people out there, if you do come across a ladderback chair, a black, ebonized black, with black oil and black stain and black wax chair, have a wee look and see. You'll know that it's a Macintosh chair because the rungs are ever so slightly curved. It's a good giveaway. That's how you can tell, because the copies are usually very flat, because that's easy to do. But as we know from our furniture makers, the real ones are dead hard to make. So if you do find one, pull it out of that skip, peeps. And also, you should just pull any old chair out of a skip and upcycle it, because of sustainability.
Jodie loves upcycling.
It's very important, guys. Very important. Right, thank you very much for joining us this month and listening to us talk about chairs. We will see you, but not see you, because it is still a podcast, next month. Thank you very much.
Bye, guys. Thank you.